Well, fellow visitors, welcome to the Marxist School of Sacramento. Tonight our speaker is David McNally. He's a professor of political science at York University. He's also the author of this book, Global Slump, The Economics and Politics of Crisis and Resistance. It's a fine read. I recommend it highly. In David's book, he argues that far from ending the 2007-2008 crisis has brought us an era of worldwide economic and political turmoil. David's analysis makes clear the basic features of a gendered and racialized system of capitalist production that's based on exploiting people and nature to increase private profits. Further, David details resistance, or the fight back to the crisis around the world. Two things. Number one, stay for the discussion after the talk. Actually, three things. Get copies of David's book for your friends and family, as the invisible hand intended so. And lastly, we have coffee and tea in the back. There is hot and cold water available. You must walk around the table to get it. I won't bore you with the details why. At any rate, we're in for a fine talk tonight, so in discussion as well. So let us welcome David McNally.
I'm not going to stand back here and use the microphone if that's acceptable to you folks. I think you can all hear me if I project my voice about how I'm doing it now. Let me begin, of course, by thanking Seth for that introduction and the Marxist School of Sacramento for hosting my visit and my discussion with you. I also need very much to thank my publisher, PM Press, some of whom wears I know Rams is very happy to make them available to you afterwards, and also to thank and acknowledge my editor of PM, Sasha, who is also here for our discussion tonight. So as Seth said, I'm very happy to take questions and open it up for lots of wide-ranging discussion after my presentation. But I do want to try to come on and have seats. I'm just getting started. Okay. As Seth said, a key claim of my book, Global Slump, is that rather than living through a sort of ordinary recession in a capitalist economy, we are going through something quite exceptional. The kind of thing which often happens only once, maybe twice in a good long lifetime, which is to say a prolonged, ongoing, protracted downturn in the whole of the global economy. One that will not resolve itself for years and years and years, and whose human consequences will be enormous. And that's really the starting point. To give you just a couple of markers for how we think about this week in and week out, consider that in the last 72 hours, Washington has delivered the largest ever cut to federal government spending in its history, and that everybody involved knows this is just an installment. This is just one payment on a wave of cuts that will roll on for years to come. Then consider, secondly, that today the U.S. government released figures which, if you read the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and so on, apparently shocked economists, which is that last month, 412,000 more people registered as unemployed, applied for unemployment or jobless benefits than the month before, and this was dramatically higher than economists had been expecting. Now, my contention is that these two things are, in fact, symptoms of the global slump that I'm talking about. And that, in fact, I'll come back in a few minutes and talk about the reality that, yes, there are economic fluctuations within a global slump. There were in the 1930s as well. When I use this term, I'm not saying there will never be a month or even a year where there's a little bit of uptick in economic activity. What I'm saying is that we're in a period in which there will be large and repeated sharp contractions in the economy, where economic activity will actually fall, and then there will be very tepid and shallow upturns for a while, but they won't be substantial enough to even begin to make a meaningful dent in unemployment and so on. Again, I'm going to come back and expand on some of this for you, but I do want to give you a picture at the beginning of what I'm trying to say, what my argument is when I'm describing this as a period of global slump. And so, in terms of the two events that I've talked about this week, another jump in the average numbers of people applying for jobless benefits and the big cuts in Washington, expect more of both of those. Now, in saying it's no ordinary recession, I want to step back and review with you some of what we have seen since 2008, and then I'm going to step back further and talk about why this happens and what has gone on in the world economic system over the last 3 decades or so. Let's start though with the last few years. We saw, beginning in March of 2008, something that many economists, I think, believed was literally impossible, which is to say the meltdown of every major investment bank on Wall Street. Starting with the collapse of Bear Stearns in March of 2008, one after another, as if you just pushed the first domino and it just kept hitting all the rest. They just kept going down. And, of course, this was not just a U.S. phenomenon. Major banks, not your little community savings and loans, but major global banks with worldwide operations went under in Germany, Ireland, Britain, Italy, Spain, and so on. In other words, this was also a globalizing banking crisis. It showed no signs of ending. And that's why all of a sudden, shock commentators could be found all over the business media saying, this is like the 1930s. This looks just like 1929 again. And in a number of respects, they were right, even though the way this is playing out is different in important and fundamental ways that I'll talk about. At the beginning, it had all of those characteristics. A dramatic crisis of the banking system. Then global manufacturing corporations, which announced themselves to be effectively bankrupt. Remember, General Motors and Chrysler were broke. They literally didn't have enough cash to get 3 or 4 months longer through their expenses, their business expenses, without having to declare bankruptcy. You're talking about some of the largest manufacturing corporations in the world that were starting to go under, as well as major banks. That's what was going on in 2008-2009. This was a context in which the most distinguished business paper in the English-speaking world, the Financial Times of London, started in March of 2009 to run a column, a series, called The Future of Capitalism. Now imagine that. I mean, we had been told for so long that there was no other future, that nothing else was even imaginable, and all of a sudden, the editors of the Financial Times of London were saying, we've got to talk about the future of this system, and they began the series with a statement from the editors which said, the world of the last three decades is gone. And I think they were right. Even though they're tending not to say those things at the moment, I think they were right in saying that. They recognized that there was a calamity on a scale that most of them had never experienced before. And as I say, in a few minutes, I'll step back and try to talk about that. All right, but I also said to you a minute ago that it started off just like the Great Crash of 1929 and 30, but it hasn't evolved on the same pattern. And the reason for that is that central banks the world over did something they did not do in the 1930s, which is to say, in a coordinated fashion, led by the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, they intervened on the most massive and dramatic scale that central banks and governments have ever intervened in the economy. But let me be clear what I mean by intervening. It was a bailout. It was a bailout of the banks. They basically said to bankers, in violation of every free market thing they preach, and keep that in mind, remember, the free market's supposed to be free, right? You take your profits and you take your losses. No. You take your profits and the rest of the population covers your losses. That's, in fact, what the scenario was. And their first injections into the banking system not being enough, they just kept doing it and doing it and doing it until by about, September of last year, they had pumped in about $21 trillion by way of bank bailouts, the bailouts to a few multinational corporations like General Motors and Chrysler, and the stimulus programs that governments had used to try to revive the world's economy. And I like often when I'm doing these sorts of presentations to not just throw the figure $21 trillion around, but give you a benchmark for thinking about it. That $21 trillion is the equivalent of the total value of everything produced, all the wealth produced in the U.S. in the course of 18 months. It's as if everything, all the goods and services that people produced for a year and a half were just thrown into the banking system and a little bit of it used as stimulus programs. Okay? That's why I say it was massive and it was unprecedented and it was coordinated. All these central banks worked together to pull this off. Well, if they couldn't have stopped the banking collapses with that, then frankly, I can't imagine what they could have done. Really, at that point, it would have been pull up magic wands and say, start incanting spells, because frankly, that's incredible, that level of intervention, that level of bailout. But it did stop the bank collapses. And doing that and then pumping in the stimulus program, they also were able to stop the massive growth in joblessness. They haven't been able to restore jobs, but they were able to stop the rising figures of joblessness by the millions every couple of months. Those figures have remained relatively stable where they are. Having said all of that, let's also be clear that while they prevented the bottom falling up to the same depths as in the 1930s, it's sort of like it started to track the 1929 crash. It looked all the way down like it was 1930, looked like we were going into early 1931, and then they got a floor under it, rather than continue to drop well into 1932, even 33, like it did in most of the world before. It's as if they stopped it halfway down into a depression. But whether they can really get it back up again is another very, very big question. But let us never forget, while I'm throwing around some of the economic figures and statistics, the human dimensions. It is really important always to underline this. In the United States, the combined unemployment and underemployment rate is over 19%. Now what that means is you take the people who have no work, and then you take the people who are looking for full-time work and can only find part-time. In other words, they are, as the economists like to say, involuntarily working part-time. They're not saying, oh, I like 2 days a week. They want a full-time wage or salary. And when you put those two together, you've got more than 19% of the U.S. population. For African Americans and Latinos, it's about 25%. So for certain sections of the population, we are talking about depression level unemployment figures. And this is also the case in parts of Europe. If you take Ireland, the official unemployment rate is now about 14%. Spain, it is 20%. Remember, these are the official figures, which we always know are a little bit cooked, right? They're giving the system the benefit of the doubt on these figures. Youth unemployment across Europe is in the 30% range. Again, depression levels. And then, of course, as many of you will know, because it's been discussed in a lot of the mainstream media, when we move into, say, North Africa, the Middle East, and so on, you're often talking of 40 and 50% unemployment rates for those under 30. Okay? So that's some of the human scale, and it's really important to register and record that. Now, let me spend a minute on this whole business of so-called recoveries within a period of global slump. Because I mentioned this to you earlier, but I want to just elaborate a little bit more on it. That when we talk about a global slump, we're not saying it plummets and then it just stays in the same position. There are fluctuations. There are movements up and down. But we need to remember that was true of the 1930s. In the 1930s, there were 20 quarters, 20 periods of 3 months in which the economy grew in the United States during the Depression of the 30s by more than 5%. For the year of 1935, the American economy, we call this the Great Depression, it grew by 7.7%. In 1937, it grew by 14%. Okay? There was a movement upwards for several years, and then in 1937, what happened? Well, keep this in mind, because, of course, they're starting to move down this path again. Roosevelt's economists convinced him that the economy was vigorous and robust again, and they could withdraw all the stimulus spending. And they withdrew the stimulus, and boom, the bottom fell out again. Okay? Now, I'm not saying it'll happen in exactly the same way. Don't misunderstand me. I don't believe historical events repeat themselves exactly in the same way. But what I am suggesting to you is that the fact that they're registering 2.6% growth in the U.S. right now, A, is only half of what it was half of the time during the 1930s. Okay? It's barely enough to keep pace with population growth. Okay? If you grow by 2.5% to 3% in the U.S., all that means is that the unemployment rate shouldn't go up very much because you're able to absorb in the labor market something equivalent to the growth of the population. But you're not generating a job recovery. The millions of jobs that were lost 2008, 2009, early 2010 don't come back in that scenario. So it is important when economists say to us, oh yeah, but look, I can show you economic statistics of a recovery, that we pause and say, okay, what does this really add up to? How does it compare with other historical periods? And what does it mean in terms of what is required to make a substantial dent in unemployment? And the answer is that they're not even close at this point. Most of the economists who I think have crunched the numbers in a serious way suggest that the Bush-Obama stimulus has added about 1%, maybe a little more than 1%, to economic growth, maybe between 1 and 1.2%. In other words, almost half of the economic growth that has been going on over the last year or so has been stimulus driven. And now not only are they moving to withdraw the stimulus, but worse, as you know, big, big cuts to federal spending, state spending, municipal spending, and so on, which is going to add up possibly to the, you know, kind of a reverse stimulus effect where you're withdrawing demand from the economy as you withdraw people's wages, salaries, the spending that they do, and so on. One really nice formulation was put forward by an economist who's not really a very nice person some time ago, but he captured something real when asked about the claim by a lot of his colleagues in the economic profession that we're in a recovery. And he said, we're experiencing a statistical recovery and a human recession. And in global slump, I take that formulation and I just push it one step further, which is to say, we're experiencing a statistical recovery for profits because of the human recession. Okay? In other words, what we've seen is the compression of wages. Some unions have just given back massively, as the Auto Workers Union did, for instance. They just gave back billions of dollars in their own wages, benefits, and pension entitlements. Furthermore, employers have squeezed labor using all of the techniques they learned during this long period that we call neoliberalism, so-called lean production, of getting the greatest quote-unquote efficiencies out of labor, and they ratcheted up the pressure on labor. At one point last year, there was one quarter where the productivity of labor in a three-month period jumped 9%. I mean, that's astronomical. Overall, last year, the productivity of labor in the U.S. went up over 5%, which means that you're getting 5% more human energy out of people. Big surprise that one indication after another shows that people are more stressed, less healthy, and so on, because the human body and psyche break down if you continually speed up our motions. And of course, you know, those of you who know Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times will know that, of course, he captures precisely that imagery, the idea of being constantly sped up by the wheels of production in our society. That's really what has boosted profits, the combination of compressing wages and speeding up workers' work lives, which they like to call the productivity of labor, most of us call the stress that gets imposed upon us. That has produced a statistical recovery of profits. American corporations return from unprofitable to highly profitable through this cycle. But it doesn't mean that the economy itself is in any position to take off. And one of the big indicators of that is that U.S. corporations are sitting on more cash than ever before. Now, the last time I looked, the figure was $2 trillion that they're just sitting on in cash and not investing. Which, by the way, somebody corrected me the other night and said it's actually $3 trillion. I don't know if that's true. I haven't had a chance to verify that. So I'll stick with my $2 trillion for the moment. But what's a trillion between friends anyway? We're having this kind of discussion. But think about that when the right-wingers and the mainstream economists come along and say, we've got to cut corporate taxes so that they'll invest. No, they're not investing. And they're not precisely because what they call capacity utilization, how much they're already using the machinery, the equipment, and so on in their factories and other places of work, is still very, very low. It hasn't come anywhere near the level where they have to think about large-scale new investment. If you're only using your equipment at 67% of capacity, not a lot of need to go and retool and re-equip to buy either more or the latest state-of-the-art technologies. And so they're largely sitting on this cash, or they're speculating. with it. And the three big areas where they have been speculating in, oh, particularly the last year or so, as they become flush with cash again, is oil. Come on. Libya is driving up oil prices. I mean, it is a minuscule amount of world oil production in Libya to begin with. Okay? Moreover, the United States gets effectively 0% of its oil from Libya. So no one can tell me that's why it's going up in the gas pumps. Okay? No, no, no. Speculators are saying, we think long term, if we put our money into oil, we're going to make a profit on it. Because, by the way, capitalists don't like sitting on cash, especially when the rate of interest is negligible. They want to make something out of it. And so, oil. Another big one has been gold. And that's why you've seen ongoing rises in gold prices. And food. I'm going to come back and talk about some of the consequences of that for a moment. Remember, food prices have really been rising over the last 6 months. And the statistics I saw, which simply took us to the end of 2010, suggested that about 200 billion purely speculative investments had gone into food stocks. People, big investors, just buying up future supplies of food. It's known as buying food futures. And 200 billion has gone there. And what that has meant, by the way, is millions more who are unable to feed themselves on the planet. Yet another reminder how much the profit motive and the profit system of capitalism conflict with the basic needs of humankind. So that's where it's been going. And the idea that somehow if you reduce corporate taxes, they're going to go on great investment and job-creating boom is just pure smokescreen rhetoric to cover up just naked grabbing of wealth and speculating on it without really any higher human purposes being served. Now, I do want to take a few minutes, as I promised, and talk about, because making this claim about this current period, and talk very, very quickly about why this happens and what the historical background to this has been. And here, it's appropriate that I'm speaking for the Marxist School of Sacramento, because really I do take my inspiration for this analysis from Marx's great lifelong study of how capitalism works, which he then put together in his book Capital. And what I find particularly compelling in Marx's account is really two interconnected claims. The first, that the key to capitalism is the exploitation of labor. That, don't believe all this stuff about how ingenious they are. That they're the great innovators. Come on, didn't all five of their banks just collapse? You know, these guys are not the brightest light bulbs in the room. They are the richest. And one of the things that market systems do is persistently funnel wealth to those who already have it and away from those who don't. And so once you've got it, unless you just are, you know, complete bumbler and failure and they won't bail you out, the odds are you're going to keep accumulating it if you can find labor to hire. And basically, as Marx's analysis explains, in the most fundamental sense, you pay labor less than the value of what it creates. And so long as you can work through that arrangement, you should keep the machinery of profit churning over. But the second side of Marx's claim is that because of the competition between capitalists, they all engage in competitive investment projects, or as he likes to put it, competitive accumulation. The build-up of ever more factories, mines, mills, office complexes, shopping malls, housing developments, and so on, and the retooling of the instruments of production You try to get an edge on your competitors by getting the latest state-of-the-art technologies that allow you to produce the same good or service for less, in less time, and therefore with less cost. And, says Marx, long periods of competitive accumulation by capitalists in the market system create a system of what he calls over-accumulation. They've simply produced more automobile factories with more capacity to produce cars than the market can possibly absorb. I mean, until the latest round of plant closures, there was a figure out there in some quarters that we had something like 70 state-of-the-art automobile factories on the planet that were surplus. Okay. China had gotten so caught up in this dynamic that it now has an excess capacity to produce steel of 200 million tons per year. And that's equal to the total steel producing capacity of the whole of the European Union. But Marx's claim is that that is inevitable in a system where each competitor is trying to get an edge on the competition and trying to seize more and more of the market share. They're not thinking, is this rational for the economy as a whole? They're thinking, if I do this new investment project, can I beat out competitor X and Y and get more market share by selling the same product for less or a product with a new little innovation to it that they haven't manufactured yet, and so on. And so when we go through a long period of capitalist expansion, the overhang or the excess capacity out there really dampens down the dynamism of the capitalist economy. And the irony is, says Marx to us in his description, capitalism needs crises in order to bankrupt and drive out the least competitive ones, so that the whole of the industrial landscape can be restructured and reorganized, and you come out with fewer automobile manufacturers, fewer steel companies, fewer companies making microchips, fewer companies selling vacations to the Caribbean, fewer fast food firms, and so on and so forth. Okay, but the larger the units of capitalism get, the more devastating such collapses are. And we saw that in the 1930s. That when a family firm went under as a result of competition in the crisis of 1848, which was the first one that Marx examined, it wasn't, as they now like to say, too big to fail. Family firms could go, and you weren't talking about dislocating tens of thousands of people, with all the spillover effects, hundreds of thousands of people. But now we know. What does it mean if General Motors collapses? Chrysler. And so on. And as a result, there's so destabilizing our crises and big industrial collapses now that there's a tendency for the state to intervene to try to limit the damage or to try to stretch out the process so that it doesn't happen in one big thump. By the way, that's what they did the last time round with the crisis that began in the early 1970s. They stretched it out over multiple recessions. So the United States saw a recession of 1971-72, a recession of 1974-75, a recession of 1980-82. So they stretched out the destruction over a longer period to try to prevent the kind of catastrophic collapse of the 1930s. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw something similar to that over the next 10, 15 years, but who knows? These things can always spin out of control in very dramatic ways. Let me then come to the age of austerity, because I want to emphasize this to you. I said it at the outset, but I want to come back and unpack it a little bit. Having spent $21 trillion to bail out the system. Capital is, and the governments of the capitalist countries now have a problem. And that problem is basically how to pay back that debt. Because they borrow to do it. They borrow money from financial markets. It's done by selling treasury bills and treasury bonds and all these sorts of things. You get the world's investment community to buy your paper. But, as you know, every one of these countries is going to be running deficits for years and years and years to come. What happens is that the global financiers who buy this paper start to look at its quality. It's sort of like if all of you started to borrow from me and were giving me IOUs, at a certain point I might start to just want to ask a few questions about the creditworthiness of a few of you. You know, I'm giving you this money for the IOUs, but is this safe? Right? If you declare bankruptcy at some point, I'm gone. And that's really what's been happening with a country like Greece. For example, Greece goes back to the credit markets and the international investors say, we don't like this bet. Yeah, we'll buy Germany's debt at 2.4%, but you got to pay us 8%. Well, of course, paying 8% is a huge cost all the way down the line into the future, too. Because you're paying that off over 10 or 20 years, whatever the particular bond instrument is, depending on how long its life is. So this is, you're basically mortgaging your future if you have to go to the loan shark rates to pay. And so they're all desperate to get their so-called fiscal houses in order to keep global capital, global finance happy. To do that, they need to pay down the very borrowing they did for the great bailout. And they've got one very simple solution, and I don't think I need to tell you it's not raise corporate taxes. Their solution is very simple and straightforward. Poor and working class people will pay for the global bank bailout. And isn't it amazing that they can revive this rhetoric for people that says, you know why we have deficits? It's the nurse around the corner. It's the school teacher across the street. It's the sanitation worker who picks up your garbage on Wednesday mornings. They're the problem because they got their wages and benefits are too good. And yet, you know, that's the rhetoric they're trying to sell, when in fact it's really about paying for the corporate bailout, for the bailout of Wall Street and other financial institutions. And that's one of the things I'm paying to do in Global Slump, is to try to provide the arguments and the analysis that we can use to counter this attack on social services, on public sector workers and others, and make it very, very clear they didn't cause the crisis. The people who provide fundamental services of real human value, teaching our children, caring for the infirm, collecting the waste that our households produce, and so on, are not the problem. And their wages and benefits are not the problem. But that's their rhetoric, and so in a context in which, in the United States, there are 44 million people at the moment reliant on food aid, they're going to come and start cutting back even more. And it was quite interesting. Some of you may know the Group of 20, largest industrial nations, the so-called G20, met in Toronto in June, where I live and work. And the statement, the communique they produced at the end was so interesting. It was buried right in the middle of it, after all kinds of nice flowery language. Right in the middle of it was, all of the signatories to this communique commit themselves to austerity, to paying down government debt. Okay, there was one exception. They accepted Japan, because Japan, prior to the tsunami and the earthquake, was just in a terrible economic mess, so they recognize that they just probably pushed Japan back into crisis. All the other 19 committed themselves to do this. But interestingly as well, whereas 6 months earlier, the International Monetary Fund had coined the term for this era that we're living through, they had coined the term a decade of austerity. In the G20 communique and other documents, they changed that to age of austerity in the recognition that 10 years may not be enough. And so what they're talking about is a 10-year program of attacking social services, cutting government spending, going after public employees. A big surprise that in Wisconsin and elsewhere, they targeted the union rights of public sector workers, because of course, going after their rights to collective bargaining, the collective agreements they have and so on, is a central part of this agenda of both scapegoating them and weakening. Because it is true, public employee unions are one of the key obstacles in the path of this full-fledged austerity agenda. But that's what we're looking at, and again, to give just a little bit of comparative framing of it beyond the US case, it is so extreme in other jurisdictions that Latvia, for instance, has fired 1/3 of all its school teachers. They have laid off 20% of all public employees. In Britain, which has seen the most massive cutback budget in its history, a very, very mainstream body called the Institute for Fiscal Studies came out with a report after the new budget saying that the average British household will, by 2017-18, so we're basically talking about 6 years from now, by 2017-18, the average British household will be $4,500 poorer than it is today, as a result of increased taxes on the poor, including on consumption, and the things they will have to pay for that were previously in the public domain, that were previously public sector services that they now need to pay for. $4,500 for the average household. By the way, 2 weeks later, the Times of London came up with a report on the richest people in Britain and said, well, actually, these cuts don't matter to them because they don't need public services anyways, which is just a reminder of how class-biased all of this is. But really, I think what all of that adds up to is the fact that for the next 10 years or more, we're going to be in a situation where governments and the employing class are coming persistently to claw back, roll back, and carve up social services, reduce public sector jobs, wages, benefits, pension entitlements, and so on. And where I think we're going to also see wave after wave of resistance to that, just like we did in Wisconsin over a month or so ago. Now, that's the last point that I take up in Global Slump, and I'll just talk really from the last 5 or 6 minutes about precisely this issue. I call the last chapter Toward a Great Resistance? And I started off by trying to remind all of us that it isn't true that working class people have failed to offer any resistance to the Great Recession and the earliest assaults of the Age of Austerity. They have actually tried to resist. I would argue that most of the time it has not been on a sufficient scale in terms of what's required, because the stakes have really changed. And in this context, what social movements, unions, student organizations, and so on have to do to resist will require much more than we're used to. Just like previous periods, just like the 1930s, require the labor movement to reinvent itself and to use tactics like the sit-down strikes and so on. This will also be true this particular period that we're living through. But as I do want to also remind you that people have resisted. And I'm always struck, particularly when I'm able to speak to groups in the U.S., that actually the first factory occupation of the Great Recession began here in the United States, in Chicago, at Republic Windows and Doors factory in December of 2008, when a Bank of America-backed company said it was shutting down. It wasn't even getting the severance pay that workers were entitled to under the law. Yeah. Never mind collective agreements. Under the law. Okay? And this was a company, Bank of America, you know, finances it, and guess who had been to the bailout window? Big time. Yeah, Bank of America. But in fact, we got the first factory occupation there. Over the next 6 months or so, in southern Ontario, where I live, 5 auto parts factories were occupied by workers confronted with layoffs and plant closures. There were big factory occupations in Ireland, in Scotland, in England, and so on. In France, some of you will have heard, they took the factory occupations to a new level with the so-called boss nappings. Okay, if occupying the factory doesn't do it, then hold the boss hostage as well. And by the way, that tends to force them to negotiate a little bit more than if you just occupy the factory and the boss is off at home somewhere. And by the way, not surprisingly, they got better results. They did actually keep some factories open, and they got some written guarantees. Yes, no, no. Closure only will be talked about until 2015 or what have you. Well, you know, you get 5-6 extra years. Okay, that's a concession. Moreover, we've seen a big wave of general strikes, predominantly in Europe, but not exclusively. And I'll talk about that. Greece has seen 8 general strikes. France has seen not only several general strikes, but some of the largest mass demonstrations in history. Some commentators believe greater than the big upsurge of May, June 1968, when at one point there were clearly 1 million people in the streets of Paris, millions more across the whole country. Some people think that the biggest demonstration in Paris over the last year or so has been between 1.5 and 2 million, something like that. So I say all that because it's not true people haven't tried to resist this agenda. But so serious is the economic situation of the global slump, and so determined are ruling classes that this age of austerity would be pushed through, that they're prepared to ride out one-day general strikes. They're prepared to ride out mass demonstrations. And it's interesting, and I devote a whole section of one of the chapters of Global Slump to this, it's interesting that the general strikes which have actually succeeded have been in countries where much more radical labor movements than we're accustomed to in North America have been willing to go on unlimited general strikes. When they go out, it's not a question of, oh, we're doing this one day and then we'll be back at work, masters. It's, we're going out, and until you meet these following fundamental demands, we're not going back. And the most important and significant of these was the general strike that began in March of 2009, so just over 2 years ago, in the Caribbean, French-speaking Caribbean island of Guadeloupe, where the main trade union body first said, we're not just striking for ourselves. Therefore, two things follow. First, we want to build a mass coalition of everybody who wants to stand up against what's going on in our society. So they reached out to student groups, women's organizations, environmentalist groups, and so on, and they brought them into a coalition of about 150 groups. Second thing they said was, the fundamental thing which drives our struggle is the movement against poverty. And therefore, we demand a 200 euro a month increase for the lowest paid. 200 euros translates into about $260 US dollars. Okay? And they said, the lowest paid come first. We're asking for less for those of us who are better paid. But for those who are at the bottom of the income bracket in our society, we're demanding this 200 euros a month. They went out. After about 10 days, the government in France, because Guadeloupe is still a sort of semi-colony of France, France sent 500 troops. Big mistake. The people of Guadeloupe simply at that point threw up barricades, drove the police and these 500 soldiers off the streets. Their militancy was inflamed by this sort of colonialist tactic of sending in, you know, from the colonial heartland, sending in troops to put down and colonize. That was just too reminiscent of all the racialized, colonized history that they had experienced. And after 41 days, the French government ran up the white flag and signed, and the poorest pay did get the 200 euros a month, plus a whole series of other demands were granted. And about 2 weeks into the strike in Guadeloupe, the neighboring French Caribbean island of Martinique joined the strike. General strike swept that island as well, and once again the French government was forced to come to terms with them. So I tell that story in the book, and I'm recounting a little bit of it. I give a lot more detail in the book, but I'm sharing some of it with you because I want to emphasize that what I think we saw there was a radical working class movement that understood that the playing field had changed and the rules of the game had changed. And that the old tactics of moderate, polite, business-style unionism were just a no-go. They were not going to get any results. Bracket, I don't see what results they've been getting for about 30 years. But particularly in this period, they weren't going to get any results. And so they reinvented what it means to be a labor movement by bringing in all sections of society who wanted to fight back and by standing in the interests of the most impoverished members of their own society. And by the way, the coalition that they created was called Stand Up Against Exploitation. So it gave it that kind of image and that kind of theme. I would also say that I think we see elements of the same thing in recent rebellions in both Tunisia and Egypt. I've spoken at too much length to go into those in any detail now, but I'll simply say that the toppling of the 23-year long dictatorship of Ben Ali in Tunisia could not have happened without the general strikes called by grassroots activists of the General Union of Tunisian Workers, who basically pushed their conservative leaders to the side and took over their union federation and waged general strikes that were key and did not get covered in most of the media. And I think, by the way, that the timing of the collapse of Mubarak in Egypt was directly tied to the fact that 4 days before he stood down, a wave of strikes involving hundreds of thousands was starting to sweep the country. In other words, the revolution in the streets was now becoming a revolution in the places of work as well. And so we find ourselves as a result, I think, in what is obviously a very worrying period. The human suffering of the Great Recession and the age of austerity are simply too real for us not to be worried. Moreover, we come into it with left movements, radical movements, and trade unions, which have been weakened by a whole historic period of retreats and defeats. But I think those examples, and I think what we saw just beginning in Wisconsin, I know it got cut short, but if you watched what was going on in the occupation of the Capitol building, or any of you who saw the YouTube videos of Michael Moore's speech and so on, will know that there was a sense of solidarity of working people standing together and doing things that they hadn't done in a very long time, and most of them never before, like occupying the state capitol building and saying, this is ours. It doesn't belong to elected politicians. It is ours. It is the people's house. And drawing inspiration directly from what they had seen in the streets of Cairo. And they talked about that in the placards and so on, exhibited that. So when I say in the last chapter, towards a great resistance question mark, it's not purely rhetorical. I think it is possible. Not guaranteed, by any means. But as was true in the second half of the 1930s, where in a very real sense, the labor movement and the left reinvented itself in the US and was able to make very powerful breakthroughs despite the fact that people were living through a depression. I think the same thing is in principle possible again, and that's why I want to show a few examples which I think should give us some hope, but also some lessons, some inspiration. And as I say, I try to do that at much greater length in the book. But at this point, I'm very happy to take any questions and so on. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks very much, David, for your stimulating, interesting talk. Just going to take a short break here, pass the fundraising bucket, because we are dependent on the income of our supporters. And just to say a few words also about our Winter Spring series. We have next month as our speakers Kim Stanley Robinson and Terry Bassan. The topic of their talk right here at the Soul Collective on May 12th will be the politics of science fiction and the left. Should be a very interesting talk.
Yeah.
Next, in 2 weeks, we'll be discussing over at the SMUD Customer Service Center on 6301 S Street. We'll be discussing Mexico Failed States, New War Resistance, a monthly review article by James Cockcroft. We welcome you to that. Our complete listings are on our schedule, which is over here on the table where we have cookies and tea. Help yourself, please. The hot water is around the corner, as I said earlier, and we'd like to convene back in maybe about 5 or 10 minutes or so and have a Q&A with David McNally. Thanks very much for coming. Well, if you haven't signed our, if you'd like to be on our mailing list, we have a sign-up sheet here. You guys already have a mailing list?
Yeah.